You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. Marilyn Monroe was one of the most famous actors in the world before her life tragically ended in August 1962. In the following decades, people have investigated every facet of her life and the inconsistencies that appeared in the official explanations. However, one aspect of her life has been bubbling under the surface of ufology for almost 30 years. Was Marilyn aware of the US interest in UFOs through her romantic trysts with the Kennedys? And is it this knowledge that saw the FBI take a deep interest in all aspects of her life, and maybe even her death? To discuss his latest book, Diary of Secrets, UFO Conspiracies and the Mysterious Death of Marilyn Monroe, I welcome back author, investigator and truth seeker Nick Redfern to the show. What at first may seem just another conspiracy theory quickly falls apart due to the official documents obtained by Nick under the Freedom of Information Act, and offers us much to consider. But before that, you can support the show via our Patreon link in this week's show notes as always. Our first episode of the Paranormal Archive is on there, exclusively for subscribers, and at just $4 a month, what have you got to lose? You can also find Mysteries and Monsters across all social media platforms. Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, you can subscribe to our channel on YouTube, and you can also find our website or contact me via mysteriesandmonsters.com. As always, thank you to Dean Bestall for the artwork. The show is produced by Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys, and Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange network. Okay, let's join Nick to go deep into cover-ups and a cast of characters that may surprise you. Today, I'm delighted to welcome back Nick Redfern to discuss his latest book, Diary of Secrets, UFO Conspiracies and the Mysterious Death of Marilyn Monroe. Nick, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Paul. How's it going, mate?
I'm all right. Yourself?
Yeah, not bad at all. Yeah, we're just, as we're saying, off air, so to speak, fighting the heat, but that's not the worst thing, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. You've got the heat and we've got the thunderstorms, and it's getting quite frustrating because I'm trying to tidy my garden up, Nick. And the weather seems to plan to rain. Whenever I'm not got a day off, it seems to be lovely and sunny and I'm at work. And then, obviously, time off, the sky's open. But, ah, well, could be worse.
Well, I guess when, like me, you live in apartments, you don't have to worry about cutting the grass or whatever.
Well, there is that one bonus, my friend. There is that one bonus. This book, Nick, is very interesting to me as someone that's read a lot of your work, because as we were sort of discussing before we dove into this book and the concept behind it and the information included, this seems to be a story that's very close to your heart, which I wouldn't find surprising because Marilyn Monroe is one of those icons of Hollywood that even nearly 60 years later, people still adore her and her body of work. And obviously there are numerous conspiracies about her untimely death in 1962. So what is it that's so attracted you to this story and this confusing history that's surrounding all these allegations and alleged documentation?
Well, I'd say sort of first and foremost, it's very much sort of like it has like a human aspect to it. You know, I mean, you could write a book in a very sort of straight ahead angle, you know, the history, the names and things like this. But you know, when you're talking about, say, agents of the FBI or the CIA, that kind of thing, it has sort of more of like a black and white kind of angle. But when you're talking about famous people that everybody knows about and seeing the movies and things like that. Mm. I think it provokes more of sort of an emotional side of things as well. You know, it's not just somebody's name. It's a person that a lot of people can relate to, you know, and become a fan of, that kind of thing. So I basically took an approach where the book is sort of, it's called Diary of Secrets, but it's also written from the perspective of me almost kind of putting a diary together and going around and interviewing different people and going around the US, speaking to people who might know something about this story about Marilyn Monroe and UFOs. So that's what I basically decided to do, because I felt it was the easiest approach, was to take this chronological diary type approach, because I think otherwise, you know, jumping back and forwards from agency to agency and from the 50s to the 60s, I think that would just be too complicated. So I had a chat with the editor and the publisher, and I said, you know, I think this is really the only way we can do it, because, you know, we should do it, because people are going to get complicated. And a few people have got complicated. But in saying that, I think by doing that chronological road trip type approach, you get to see, you know, from 1 to 10, so to speak.
Yeah. The other aspect of all this is that there are such a cast of characters involved in this, not just obviously your big hitters like Marilyn and the Kennedy brothers. I mean, there are people that I'm aware of as in a cultural sense as well.
Yeah.
Dorothy Kilgallen is somebody that I was very aware of, primarily because of her involvement in the JFK case and getting that interview with Jack Ruby. And then, unsurprisingly, another strange death that she unfortunately suffered, which is another rich tapestry of conspiracy as well there, Nick. And then added to that, you've got people like Lee Israel, who is obviously probably as famous now as she's ever been because of the film version of her book about the forgeries that she made a fortune duping people around the world in the sort of late 80s and early 90s. So when you started uncovering this myriad of counterpoints, were you surprised that some of the people whose names started to appear once you'd sort of thought, I'm going to follow this trail?
No, actually, it didn't surprise me, because, I mean, you only have to sort of look at the straight and black and white normal history in that era, you know, the early 60s. I mean, you've got so many people intertwined, you know. You've got, like, the Kennedy brothers, you know, you've got, you know, actors, things like that, and, you know, you've got, it's sort of almost like a magical moment with sort of, you know, bigger than life characters. And so it's very much almost magical, as I said, bigger than life era. When you sort of people like Dorothy Kilgallen, you know, not just you know, a journalist, but one who had the ability to really, you know, sort of penetrate the inner aspects of the JFK assassination, then you've got, like, people from the eccentric to the sinister, you know, with people being wiped out left, right and center, you know. So he didn't really, you know, to get back to your question, he didn't really kind of surprise me, because I think everybody of a certain age recognizes that kind of era, sort of the 50s, 60s, you know, sort of a magical era with, like I said, these sort of larger-than-life figures, whether in politics or whether in the world of entertainment, you know.
I think it's also one of those things that Monroe's life, anyway, was rather interesting, primarily because of the people she associated with. She was kind of off the cuff and going through that kind of era in the 1950s where we got the whole Reds in the Beds kind of situation and the problems that were going on. It would be very interesting to kind of understand that that's probably what brought the FBI onto her tail, is it not?
Oh, yeah, there's no doubt about that. I mean, as far as we can tell, at least from the files that have been declassified through the US Freedom of Information Act, what we know is that the first file opened on Marilyn was in 1955. And that was actually for a really weird reason. She actually applied to the State Department to get a visa to go to the Soviet Union because, you know, she had this kind of angle, you know, or this image in the movies, or a lot of them at least, you know, this sort of ditzy, stupid blonde, which she actually wasn't. You know, she was the opposite of that and very, you know, someone who had a deep interest in, you know, world activity. And so she applied, initially applied to get a visa to go to Russia because and the Soviet Union because she wanted to see what it was like rather than being told what it's like. And Hoover was not happy about this, and he was not. Not only was he, was she, was Hoover, you know, concerned about this, but you know, it was one of these situations where there were actually a lot of other people in Hollywood who had sort of what they called leftist leanings back then. You know, and I think with the FBI, it was sort of clear that the primary reason why people like Marilyn did cause problems for Hoover was because famous people are able to, you know, impact on the public, you know, whether it's a rock star or an actor or whatever, you know, they can get the words through. So when Marilyn, you know, it got out to the media that that she was hoping to go to the USSR, it became a big story, you know, for the average person. You know, most people wouldn't care if you go to Russia or not, although might have done back in the 50s. However, you know, it's one of these situations where somebody who has that power and that clout to get things done. That's one of the reasons why the FBI created this file. Now, you can go to the FBI's website, which is called The Vault. And if you look on the search engine on the website itself, you'll be able to download as PDFs for free all the data and the files that the FBI have got on Marilyn. And it's round about 250 pages. However, there are rumors that when, in 1972, that J. Edgar Hoover died, that his the people who worked around him, all his workers, you know, the very, you know, the ones who were really kind of, you know, they'd do anything for him. The rumors are that literally somewhere in the region of round about 7,000 to 8,000 pages of material on Marilyn may actually have been shredded or burned to basically prevent, you know, the really sort of important material and just get rid of it all because some of it involved reportedly like sort of illegal wiretaps of various people, including Marilyn at her home. And so we've got this situation where, you know, there could have been literally thousands of pages of FBI file on Marilyn, but we've got a measly 200, 220, 230. But at least the ones that we have, they do actually still give a good look at, you know, the way in which the FBI did address Marilyn. For example, some of the files talk about how agents were sent even down to Mexico when Marilyn had gone on vacation, and they followed her all the way down to Mexico. And there's a lot in the files about Marilyn having an affair, an ongoing affair with Robert Kennedy. And so there's actually, it's not like a boring file. I mean, it's a really fascinating file, but it's somewhere, the, you know, whether that the larger files were destroyed, I don't know. But, you know, it could be the case that it was all, you know, just stored away somewhere. And maybe one day, you know, we'll get it, you know, if, because the rumor is that, you know, a lot of Hoover's guys, as I said, removed it all. they may not have destroyed it. They might have gone against orders and could be in some, you know, some old guy now has got, you know, four or five boxes in his attic, you know, and retired from the FBI or whatever.
Yeah, I think it also encapsulates just how paranoid Hoover was, because I think it's one of those things that he was so powerful up until his death, Nick, that he essentially had carte blanche to do whatever he wanted, not necessarily for the protection of the United States. More often, it would be anybody he saw as a threat. And obviously, his banging of heads against Robert Kennedy especially is something that's well documented these days, that Hoover had absolutely no time for the Kennedys. He saw them as a serious threat to his power.
Well, that was the thing. I mean, Hoover sort of perceived himself, I mean, bear in mind he was in, you know, he was director for decades and decades and decades. Mm-hmm. And so throughout that period, you know, from the 30s to the 70s, he sort of perceived himself as untouchable. Mm. You know, there was no way he could be touched. And what he said in the FBI goes with the FBI, you know. And so, in other words, he was the sort of person who, you know, I guess he was like a control freak. You know, he wanted his hands on everything. He wanted to know about everybody. You know, who have we got wiretapped? Who's screwing who? You know, yeah. Things like that. And what can we get on all these people that we don't like who might have these, again, these leftist leanings, as they were called back then. Mm. So, in other words, anything that had the ability in some way to affect in an adverse way Hoover, you know, he'd find a way to make sure that whatever they were doing, they would come crashing down and Hoover would still be on top, you know.
Mm, absolutely. One of the aspects, as you touched on earlier, you know, the persona or the perceived lack of intelligence, primarily based on the characters that Marilyn would portray in the films that she made, mm-hmm. was completely counterbalanced to the real person. She was a very intelligent, deep-thinking woman. And I often, when I read about the build-up to her death and what was going on with the Kennedys, it seems almost as if the fact that she was such an intelligent and deep-thinking woman was one of the problems that ended up getting her into this situation, because not only was she a world-famous sex symbol and an icon to millions, Nick, she was also a deeply well-connected and influential person, and clearly the Kennedys saw her as a trophy of some description for whatever, because they were both, you know, womanizers, and that's well recorded as well. And I think it was perhaps her intelligence and the fact that she could speak with these people on an equal footing, Nick, that perhaps led to the situation where Bobby especially sort of opened up pillow talk and ended up telling her things that perhaps a person of lesser intelligence would not have had any kind of concept of.
Well, yeah, you're right. I mean, you know, one thing, one of the most important things you said, you know, she was sort of well-learned, and she was, you know, someone who, you know, was, well, the best way I can describe it, you know, she was very emotional and in various ways, you know, and you can tell from her history and, you know, just everything about her, you know, I think, you know, reading the books, the many I had to read, you know, while I was doing the book, it's clear as to, you know, her situation. You know, she was someone who was yearning for a, you know, she wasn't bothered about, you know, having 20 guys and et cetera, et cetera. She wanted that one guy, you know, and it never really sort of went that way for her. You know, she had a lot of boyfriends and, you know, three husbands, but everything seemed to go wrong, you know. And when you're someone like her who's in a very, very often in an emotional state, then, you know, that's almost kind of like a red alert type situation. And I think more than anything else, you know, this kind of affected her, you know, when things started to go wrong in her life, then that's when she would go for like the booze and the pills, you know. In the same way that, you know, things happen like that, you know, like, for example, you know, you've got an alcoholic or a drug addict, you know, and things start going wrong in their life. They start to panic and then they turn to, you know, the substance or whatever. And then, you know, life starts to get panicky, that kind of situation. And I think that kind of sort of reflects on Marilyn when everything was going fine. Everything was going fine. Mm. If things even started to go a little bit wrong, you know, emotions started to spill over, you know, panicky, you know, low self-esteem, all this kind of thing. And then she felt she had to sort of, you know, sort of indulge herself with all these other people because she's Marilyn Monroe. She has to be seen, you know, that kind of image, you know.
Mm. Yeah, very true. Very true. And I think the repercussions of her death, because as I've mentioned as well, there have been conspiracies and theories about this, regardless of what we get into the meat and veg of your book, really, that a lot of people, even at the time, Nick, viewed her death as very suspicious.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's an important thing. You know, the whole angle of her death, you know, it wasn't like a conspiracy theory that came along, you know, in the 70s or something like that. You know, somebody just writes a book and then it rolls from there. No, it actually, you know, when she died or was found dead, shall we say, in August 1962, actually, you know, the newspapers were already, you know, barely days into her death. You know, they were saying, was this suicide or was it something more sinister? That kind of headlines, you know. And part of it was because, you know, it was widely known within the media and the world of politics, you know, that regardless of UFOs and regardless of whether it was a murder or a tragic, you know, suicide or whatever, what we can say for sure is that, you know, that a lot of people knew what was going on. So, you know, when you're hanging out with the Kennedys, you know, and so that the... If most of the researchers who have looked into it think that JFK may have had one or two situations with her, but Bobby, you know, as if the story goes, that, you know, they had sort of like a full-blown affair.
Mm.
And of course, you know, people in government, people in the media are going to know that. And of course, when you're in that, if you're Marilyn Monroe and you're in that situation and you're found dead, yeah, you know, there would be repercussions right up to the White House. You know, we've got to lock this down and, you know, make sure that we can get Bobby and JFK away from all this talk about Marilyn. But they, but the problem is they started it, you know. I mean, it's one of those situations where, well, I mean, it's like this. I mean, who wouldn't want to go to bed with Marilyn Monroe, you know? But the fact is, you know, when you put yourself in that position and then things start to get wrong and, you know, there's sort of rumors going around, you know, around the White House and things like this, you can easily see how somebody like Marilyn could find herself almost in like a national security situation. I mean, I'll give you an example. Regardless of the whole issue of UFOs again, we know for sure that at one point, well, not one point, but for a few years, Marilyn had this journal, which over the years it became known as the Red Diary and the Diary of Secrets. And that's why I called the book Diary of Secrets.
Hmm.
And rather that, you know, this, her diaries were not like, you know, dear diary, I went down to the park today and played with a dog, you know. That was not what her journal, her diary, was about.
Hmm.
What the Kennedys didn't know was that, what they were doing, the two of them, were trying to impress Marilyn into the bedroom by giving her sort of tidbits of information on some of that, the top secrets of the US government. Very sort of, dangerous thing to do. And we know from some of her friends that in that diary, she was talking about how the Kennedy brothers had told her that there were plans to assassinate Fidel Castro, to invade Cuba, to use the mafia to work with the CIA on sort of off the books type, operations that that the regular government didn't want to handle because it was just too dangerous, so they'd farm it out to the mafia.
Mm.
All of that we know was in that diary. Now, when things got bad was when the Kennedy brothers were told by their aides, hey, do you know they've got this diary? Everything you tell them, she puts it in the diary. And that's when the Kennedy brothers freaked out. They just did not realize that was happening.
Mm-hmm.
And so then Marilyn becomes a national security threat, and the diary itself, in a strange way, also becomes a threat to national security.
Absolutely, and I think the fact that this diary was so well known about, it vanished, didn't it? After she passed away, I think when her autopsy was being done and her personal possessions were collected, I think the diary was supposedly cited then, and I think you mention it in the book that somebody had a flick through it and said, yeah, there's some real powder keg stuff inside this.
Oh, yeah. And, anything like that, is guaranteed, to cause problems. And when she died in August 62, you've got the whole issue of the autopsy, et cetera, et cetera. And when her body was taken for examination, some of the staff years later came forward and said, yeah, we saw the diary and it was in the room with some of her possessions as well for about 3 days. And then a team of guys came in and all of this material, her own items that had been taken there, it was all gone. It was there for a few days, and at least none of the staff knew who, came in and who sort of allowed the order to go in and just say, hey, we're taking this, and if you don't like it, too bad, And that's pretty much what it was, her possessions were hers, by law, and certainly by her family, because the fact she was now dead. But it wasn't like that. It was, the guys just... guys in black suits come in, and you don't like it, too bad, we're taking it, and what are you going to do about it, that kind of thing. And and there have been rumors that one or two people claim to have seen the diary under unclear circumstances, but maybe like a week or two later. And there have been a couple of occasions where people claimed to have the diary and, we wanted to sell it for huge amounts of money.
Hmm.
But it never surfaced. Now, some people have said, it's either shredded or burned. My view is that I think they probably would have preserved it because, for one major reason, successive... governments, people and things like this, for whatever reason, and particularly national security reasons, they may want to keep that diary and preserve it just in case, anything else pops up and they need to refer back to that diary. So I think they would probably save it for that reason. I think maybe, you know, the ones who would want it destroyed would be the Kennedy brothers, you know.
Mm.
But I can see why there could be other people in government that would want to keep it, as I said, because, you know, one day they may have to go back. You know, 10 years later, you know, there's a national security issue concerning Marilyn and JFK, and somebody's putting out a new book about this, and they need to go back and read, you know, page 15 or 20 of her diary. That's why I think they would probably keep it. But then again, you know, keeping it makes it possible one day that somebody could, you know, sort of do an Edward Snowden and sort of sleek out, you know, with it,
yeah.
That kind of thing. So so that, you know, it's there's different ways of handling it, you know. Both of them are kind of dangerous. You know, you keep it or you destroy it.
Absolutely. And there seems to be a real theme as well that several women who met unfortunate ends, Nick, around the same period connected with JFK, all had diaries that all seemed to disappear. And I think that there are two women in particular you mention in the book.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I mean, that's a very sort of, you know, strange situation because, you know, what we sort of have in this part of the story relates to other women that you know have got these diaries, and I think probably what happened is that the Kennedy brothers probably got panicky and paranoid about this you know this particular issue of diaries, you know. I mean, I'm sure it must have been like for the Kennedys, it must be a nightmare in knowing that not just one diary exists, but for other women as well.
Mm.
Now, obviously everybody knows about Marilyn and her diary, and now another another of them was a woman named Karen Kupchinet.
Mm.
And this is kind of strange because her last film, she was an actress and sort of a growing actress, and she probably would have been you know, a really big actress in the 60s onwards.
Yeah.
And she was born in 1941 and died in 63. She was only, you know, in her early 20s. And for years, there were rumors that she'd had a brief affair with JFK. Now, one of the sort of odd synchronicities is that her last show was the original Perry Mason show. And the episode was called The Case of the Capering Camera. And that was actually on TV here about 4 days. Which is one of those really kind of creepy, weird coincidences or synchronicities, you know.
Yeah.
But what's interesting is, and it gets a little bit convoluted, is that Karen Kupchinet's father was named Irv, and he was good friends in the 1940s with Jack Ruby, who just happened to shoot and kill Lee Harvey Oswald.
Yeah.
And and she had a diary, and that diary vanished. Now, the other woman is Mary Pinchot Meyer. And she actually, you know, was in the Kennedy family, and she was found dead in October 1964 with two bullets to the head, or one in the back, one in the head.
Mm.
And it looked like it clearly had been done sort of like close range execution style.
Yeah.
And she had a diary as well, and. And we know now that because that diary was actually seen and read by a number of people before that vanished as well, and it talked about how she was basically in love with JFK, and he was the the lore today, if you like, is L-O-R-E, is that that he was actually in love with her but couldn't get out, you know, things. He's the president and he's married, you know, to Jackie. Hmm. There's no way he could divorce, you know. And when she was found dead as well, you know, with this diary, you know, bullet in the back, bullet in the head, made it look like it was sort of, you know, like a, you know, just some, like a mugger or something like that. But when you've got three very, very similar situations, three diaries, all with a Kennedy connection, you know, you have to wonder, you know, I mean, is this coincidence, or does it really come down to, you know, somebody is actively trying, getting rid of these women and getting rid of their diaries, if possible, or at least confiscating them. So, you know, in that sense, you've got these sort of spring-offs, you know, from the original story, which, you know, then adds to different parts to it, you know. With everybody thinks it's just one diary, then you find there's two more women, two more diaries, and all three are dead. You know, it's a really bizarre kind of sinister story.
Yeah, it is, and it kind of feeds into it, because obviously the Kennedy assassination is known throughout across the world, Nick, and there have been numerous discussions and countless documentaries and books and films even. One of my favourite Oliver Stone films is his JFK film. And it's interesting that this whole UFO conspiracy kind of kicks off, I think it was towards the end of the 80s, early 90s, where people started to say that the real reason Kennedy was assassinated was that he was going to go public about UFOs.
Well, yeah, this is where the story that sort of joins UFOs with Marilyn Monroe and, you know, the Kennedys and all intertwines. The first person who talked about this idea or this scenario of a JFK UFO link was John Lear. And John Lear was a pilot, worked for the CIA, still alive, and an active person in the UFO field. And he claimed to have known of inside information where supposedly in the early part of 1963, and Kennedy was killed in November 63, one of the things that the story was that in early 1963, when supposedly Kennedy was briefed by the intelligence community about the UFO subject, and not just sort of lights in the sky or Project Blue Book kind of situations, but, you know, the rumors were, you know, the government's got crashed UFOs and dead aliens, and now you're the president, and we've decided, you know, the intelligence community's decided, you know, to show you what we've got, you know. And supposedly it was a case of taking Kennedy to Area 51, and by then, you know, there's no turning back when you've seen all that, you know. And then supposedly Kennedy took the view or the approach that the intelligence community never expected. He said, well, I'm going to tell the public, rather than, yeah, this is a national security issue, we need to lock it down. And so that's, you know, if you look into the story, you know, there was a lot of different people and organizations and agencies that wanted Kennedy gone, you know. So I think this could have been almost like a near unique situation where agencies and groups, including maybe the mafia, all had reasons for wanting Kennedy gone. And so, as I said, this almost unique first time, multiple different groups and so on may have got together, and, you know, they all just basically said, let's all look the other way, nobody names anybody, we just get this done and then we all walk away, that kind of thing. And that may explain why, you know, there do seem to be mafia links and there do seem to be Cuban angles to it, and there do seem to be, you know, a Russian angle, and so on and so on. And that may be because, as I said, you know, in this unique situation, maybe they really did all get together, and somebody wanted him gone because of the UFO angle. Somebody else wanted him gone for this or that. Now, that was sort of the late 80s, and the story didn't really take off again until 1995, and this part of the story revolves around a guy named Timothy Cooper. Timothy Cooper was someone very active in the UFO scene from around about 1989 until, well, actually, he's still quietly active now, but he doesn't really do anything, you know, sort of on the net or anything like that. But Cooper was someone who claimed to have had a number of sort of insider types in government, and also elderly whistleblowers who may have sort of purloined files from the archives when they left the CIA or the NSA, things like that. And although I never met Cooper, I did actually sort of get involved with all his work and so on, and he literally had thousands of pages of what I would call questionable documents, because you couldn't tell if they were the real deal or if they were, you know, really old, you know, were they old fakes, that kind of thing, or were they new documents made to look sort of fading and aging and yellow paper and that kind of thing. But regardless of whether or not the documents were real or not, they looked the real deal. We know that the typeface on the paper did match that era, the typewriters from the 1950s and 60s. So if these documents were all hoaxes, then somebody would have had to get literally round about 7 or 8, 9 or 10 typewriters, because on all these pages, you know, there's so many documents, there were so many different typewriters as well. So somebody, you know, if the documents aren't the real deal, then somebody went to the, you know, the extent of getting like 13 or 14 1950s era, 1960s typewriters and the fonts and all that kind of thing. Now, according to Cooper, he got most of all these files from this very elderly man that he called Thomas Cantwell, or Cantwheel, I should say. And the story is that most of those files came to Cooper that way, and within those files was a one-page document purported to be a CIA document that was a wiretap of two people, one Howard Rothberg and the other one Dorothy Kilgallen. Dorothy Kilgallen was, for people who may not know, was a very sort of astute expert journalist, and she did a lot of investigative journalism. And Howard Rothberg was a good friend of hers, and he was a house designer. And the reason why they seem to be within that document is actually for sort of a simple reason when you know it. Back in the 1950s, Dorothy Kilgallen went on vacation to the UK and met with a number of reportedly high-ranking UK military personnel who sort of gave her snippets of information on a crashed UFO story and dead aliens and so on. And this really caused Dorothy Kilgallen to continue to, you know, dig into the whole UFO subject. And we know that Kilgallen had shared information about what she'd been told about UFOs and dead aliens. she'd shared that as well with Howard Rothberg. And Kilgallen and Rothberg were sharing some of these UFO stories with other people. And if you read the document, it's very clear that the CIA was extremely disturbed by the fact that Rothberg and Kilgallen were starting to spread these stories about UFOs, ties in with the Kennedy brothers, the Cuba stuff. And so the document demonstrates that Kilgallen's home and Rothberg's home were both being wiretapped, as was Marilyn's. We know that for sure. And the document talks about Marilyn's diary of secrets and what the government would do if it became visible, you know. But more than that, the document itself is dated one day before Marilyn's death in August 1962. So you've got this situation, this sort of controversial, questionable document that looks the real deal, that has the right type font, the right typewriter, the right time frame, and it's structured very well. You know, it actually, some things have come out, you know, since the document surfaced that sort of add even more to it. But the important thing is that, you know, it is put together in a good way. And that's when, in 1995, when this document went public. And what happened was that Cooper was good friends, or became good friends, I should say, with a man named Milo Spiriglio. And Milo Spiriglio was he was an author. He wrote three books on Marilyn, but he was also a private detective, as was Timothy Cooper. Mm. That's how they got to know each other. And so what happened was that Cooper handed over the documents, the Marilyn documents, to Spiriglio, who then held a press conference in California. And that's how the document got out into the public domain, and it's also how the Marilyn UFO Kennedy Kilgallen story began to take off.
Absolutely, and it's really very interesting because, as we're both very aware, Nick, throughout the years of ufology, there have been people who have gone out of their way to deliberately cause disinformation to seep out into the public.
Yeah.
And Cooper was, you know, finding these documents seemingly being delivered through the goodwill of this deep throat contact that he'd made. And yet, it seems a very strange thing for somebody to just create for me, because there doesn't seem to be any need to add any more conspiratory layers to the Kennedy assassination than there already were, Nick. So I was always very surprised when this kind of often gets overlooked when people look at the Kennedy situation, but primarily, I think, because it was ufology and people didn't want to sort of rope that into everything else in regards to the mafia or, you know, a CIA hit on their own president or dark forces in the US government creating it. And yet, I'm often struck that why would someone create such a forgery if there wasn't something to it, because as you say, Kilgallen's interest in ufology was very well known, and as you say, she was a damn fine journalist and one of those that investigated situations that took her to dark places, and primarily is once again something that people often put forward as a theory for her strange death, because as we touched on earlier, she was found dead in bed, but it wasn't her bed. It was at the guest room, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, which she never used that at all. No?
Yeah, full makeup as well, apparently, and she was wearing a hairpiece suit. She basically looked like she was about to go out rather than go to bed.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, but when you talk about, you know, this this angle, you know, putting this together. I mean, there really isn't any kind of logic to create in the document, because what happened was, as I said, the timeline, if you like, you know, the Cooper gets the document from this old guy, Thomas Cantwell, and he then decides, Cooper decides to hand it over to Milo Spiriglio. He puts on the press conference, and it was in the UFO magazines and the early, you know, online net sites and things like that. But the important thing is, nothing happened with it after that. You know, you would think that if this was the work of like a major significant forger, you would think, well, you know, I'm going to get some money out of this, because this, real or not, you know, I'm going to get, you know, I'm going to write a book, you know, that kind of thing. Like Spiriglio had already written 3 books on Marilyn.
Mm.
And he could easily have done a 4th one on the UFO angle. We're talking about mid-90s now. We're talking, you know, more than around about 20-something years ago.
Mm.
And so, and yet Spiriglio didn't do anything with it. Cooper didn't do anything with it other than give it to Spiriglio. So, you know, the idea of having to go out and get an old-style typewriter, the font, everything, the paper, this yellow paper, all that kind of stuff, you know, would take a great deal to forge something. It could be done quite easy, but it would require, you know, a significant amount of work to do that. But what would be the point when it really sort of languished in nothing for years, you know? And occasionally, you know, if you do sort of a Google search, you know, Marilyn Monroe UFO, that kind of thing, you know, you'll see maybe about 10 or 11, 12, 15 articles that have been written between now and going back to like 1995. It's not like it's been, you know, all over the place. So the big question is, why would someone go to all that effort? You know, nobody even jumped out the shadows and said, gotcha, you know, that kind of thing, is, you know, just to make everybody in ufology look stupid, you know, that kind of thing. But that, again, that never happened. The document was just shown, it was circulated, it was the subject of a number of articles. That's it, you know. And that's one of the things that fascinates me, that it doesn't go along the average hoax. You know, I mean, I'm not going to name names, but there's some people I know in ufology who have fabricated, you know, photographs, books, you know, they've made things up, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But they did it for money. You know, they did it for, you know, to get on the lecture circuit or to write books, that kind of thing. Nobody did anything that with the Marilyn story, and that's why I decided to write my book, to tell the whole story, you know, this whole thing of where it began in sort of 1980s with Leah, and then, you know, Cooper gets the document. And, you know, I felt it was a fascinating story enough to, you know, chronologically to go from A to Z, you know, and see where it all goes.
Absolutely. And I think, like you say there, especially in the mid-90s when this story breaks, it's the zeitgeist for ufology, really.
Yeah.
It's kind of like the big thing. The X-Files is the biggest show in the world. Everybody's thinking that there's shady operations going on in the US government. They've covered it up. Why didn't somebody just go the whole hog? And as you say, I think that's where we get this kind of connection with Lee Israel as well, because obviously at this period of time, Lee Israel had written a book about Dorothy Kilgallen's life, and then...
Yeah.
Found herself embroiled in a fascinating fraud case that she ended up doing a plea bargain, I believe.
Yeah.
To avoid a prison sentence. And obviously there's a fairly recent film called Can You Forgive Me? Which stars Melissa McCarthy and Richard E. Grant. And basically she was forging documents by famous authors and flogging them. Were you unsurprised to see that people were kind of trying to tie her to the creation of this document, Nick? And if so, she clearly got caught because she got greedy. She would have known the value of creating such a false document, would you not suspect?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you can look at it from two ways. I mean, the one angle is that, you know, we know that Lee Israel, who in the 70s and 80s was a well-respected writer, you know, primarily biographies, and she wrote one on Dorothy Kilgallen. So she obviously knew, and I've got that book, and I read it all the way through while I was doing the research on the book, and it's clear, you know, that anything that needed to be known about Dorothy Kilgallen, that Lee Israel had that information, you know. And we've got this situation where years later, when work starts to drop off, you know, and things like this, she then goes down this path, which is just, you know, the most craziest, dangerous thing to do. You know, she started to fabricate letters and fabricate documents. And now, one of the interesting things is that all of the people who are mentioned in that Marilyn document are also mentioned in the Lee Israel biography of Dorothy Kilgallen. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean there's like a, you know, the red light should go on, but it is an interesting factor. And that somebody who decided in the late 80s, early 90s to start fabricating letters and documents, it's intriguing that the one person who should have just decided to do that, also you could make a case, you know, had at least some connections to that Marilyn document. If not, you know, there's an incredible you know, sort of coincidence. For example, you know, JFK, RFK, Howard Rothberg, Dorothy Kilgallen, they're all mentioned in the document, they're all mentioned in the biography. But then you could say, well, you know, they would be in the biography and they would be in the documents, you know, if it was all accurate. So, you know, you can look at it from the perspective that maybe she, I mean, there's three ways you can look at it. One is that it was all a big coincidence and Lee Israel had no kind of connection at all with any of this. Another one is the possibility that somebody else did it and it just looked like, you know, it could have been Lee Israel. But then, you know, you've got the other angle that because she dug so deep into Dorothy Kilgallen's life, it makes me wonder if she actually did find something, you know, sort of amazing about the UFO angle. And maybe then she put it out there, not as a fake, because she wanted to get the story out, you know, that maybe she found something when she was doing the biography. I mean, granted, that's, you know, speculative, but, you know, it's possible. But I think somewhere there is a Lee Israel connection to some degree, but I'm just not sure even now, you know, to what degree that is.
Yeah, I think the thing that kind of pulls her away for me, Nick, is the fact that everything else she did was for financial gain. She didn't earn anything from creating whatever. And you would say, well, why would she do this? Unless she, because you have to understand, you have to know who Tim Cooper was at that time, I would suspect, to even consider. And then why would you decide he was the ufologist you wanted to create this document for?
Well, that's right. Yeah, I mean, in the book, you know, I've got an entire chapter on that whole Lee Israel, you know, the Spiriglio document. And you're right. The one thing that really does stand out is the fact that as far as we can tell, nobody may ever made any money off that document. And Lee Israel was in that era, late 80s, early 90s, Lee Israel was totally into making money off these forged documents. And, you know, so from that perspective, you know, I mean, that pushes away from her. But I do wonder if she, as I said, you know, that she may have known something about it, you know, in terms of what the story was. I mean, I think it's very unlikely that if you're going to write a book about Kilgallen and at some point, you know, Kilgallen we know was involved in the UFO subject, you know, there's no way Lee Israel could not have found that out, you know, that Kilgallen was interested in UFOs. I mean, the whole thing, you know, as it relates to Lee Israel and the document, it could just be one of those really weird coincidences. And that could happen because, you know, the people who were sort of in the book and the people who are in the documents are real people, you know, and so it's easy to see, you know, how they would actually in real life all come together.
Very true. But then again, would she be aware that Kilgallen was on the CIA's radar, I suspect, Nick? Do you think she would have she uncovered that, or was that something that's only kind of come out as we've got freedom of information and declassification of these secret wiretaps that were going on?
Well, there are actually two connections between Lee Israel and the CIA. One of them is that, one of them is that Lee Israel, when she was writing her book on Kilgallen, she actually approached the CIA to see if the CIA had any documents on Kilgallen that could be declassified. Lee Israel had found out at some point in the late 70s that the CIA had a file on Kilgallen, and she tried to get that through the Freedom of Information Act, and she only got about 15 or 16 pages. Reportedly, there were hundreds on Dorothy Kilgallen. I mean, the FBI file is like 2 inches thick on Kilgallen, so that gives you an idea of how thick the CIA file would be. So you've got, in that sense, you've got Lee Israel, investigating the CIA side of this, but also approaching the CIA directly to use the Freedom of Information Act to get material as well. So, you know, we do have a CIA Lee Israel connection. There's no doubt about that, you know.
It's a good way to get attention as well, I would suspect. Perhaps the attention she didn't want as well, Nick.
Yeah, and I mean, I think there may well be more to this aspect of the whole story, but it's, you know, it's one of these sort of convoluted, sort of winding tales. it's just a bizarre aspect of the story. But yeah, I totally agree with you. That one angle that nobody tried to really get something out of that document. Yeah. Never happened. And I really would have thought, even Spiriglio, having written 3 books on her, and then he gets this CIA document about dead aliens and crashed UFOs, you would think he'd be like, oh my God, you know, I've got to get my agent, you know, and get me a new deal, you know. That did not happen. He just said, okay, this is what I've got. Do what you like with it, which itself, you know, is almost as if he didn't really want to touch it, you know.
Yeah, trying to get someone else to do the work, because Spiriglio was someone that wasn't publicity shy either, Nick, which is often another aspect of this that surprises me, that he didn't do more with it, because he was quite well known for having celebrity cases, and he enjoyed the limelight, didn't he?
Oh, yeah. I mean, he kind of viewed himself as like a real-life Sam Spade, you know, that kind of thing. You know, sort of like, you know, just like a classic 1940s era sort of, you know, private detective, you know, with your long coat and your trilby and, you know, sort of like Humphrey Bogart, you know, in something like an old detective, you know, movie, you know. I mean, he did that partly, you know, for image.
Hmm.
But he really was a really good, solid private detective. But, I mean, it's interesting you bring up Spriglio because one of the things that happened while I was doing the research, I thought, well, you know, I'll approach the CIA, you know, Freedom of Information Act, and see if there's anything on him. And turned out there was. I got around about 40 or so pages from the CIA, which showed that the CIA had been watching him for years. And basically what they were doing, any time that Spriglio, if his name appeared in like New York Times, you know, this newspaper, that newspaper, they would carefully clip all the newspaper, articles. They would photocopy them and put notes and lines under the important things where it said words like Cuba and diary. That's literally in all the documents. Mm. So, in other words, you've got the CIA carefully and quietly collecting all of the articles, and they had copies of these books as well, but they had all these articles on Spriglio, as I said, you know, just about everything that you know he was working on would be added into the Spriglio file, and we're talking about, you know, way up to sort of the late 1980s and into the 90s. So in that sense, you know, we're looking at an ongoing surveillance, if you like, of all of Spriglio's work, which articles his articles are going to be in this newspaper or that newspaper, and it really did amaze me when I saw, you know, going through these newspapers that the CIA had photocopied. What fascinated me more than anything else was the fact, you know, the things that appear in the Spriglio documents were all in the CIA file, were all underlined. You know, as I said, the word diary, secrets, Kennedy's, murdered. Somebody had got like a black marker pen at the CIA and underlined all those words in all those articles. So this was not just some sort of vague kind of, oh yeah, we'll keep our eye on him now and again. No, this was like the complete opposite of that.
Yeah. Do you think the CIA thought he'd seen her diary or got hold of a copy of it?
Well, I don't know if they thought he'd got a copy of it, but I think they were absolutely sure that he'd got some dirt on the CIA. Yeah. Mm. And I think that's primarily the reason why that they, you know, he could embarrass them if he wanted to. That's, yeah, I think, what it came down to more than anything else.
Yeah, absolutely. Because, you know, with the greatest respect, writing about the tragic life and mysterious death of a film star would not normally come under the radar of national security, would it not, Nick?
No, it wouldn't. And, you know, and you would think that the articles, you know, when they photocopied them and put them all in the file, you would just put the file, you put the article in the file. You know, I've never really sort of heard of somebody just carefully getting this little black marker and just under all these key words, which are also key words in the document, the Marilyn UFO document as well. So,
yeah.
Even the words like Cuba and Fidel, they're all underlined as well. Yeah.
Yeah. Everything seems to be leading back to JFK again.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's one of these situations where, you know, the president's the person who has a lot of secrets. And of course, you know, when you've got scandals in your life as well, I mean, you know, it sort of becomes an inflammatory kind of situation. And, you know, it's difficult to sort of say, you know, who's watching who for what reason, and was that person really just dying their sleep, you know, or not? There's so many kind of angles and aspects in a situation like this, you know, when you're trying to figure out the truth, I guess.
Yeah, very much so. Because I would imagine, Nick, when you get something like this and it's just a one-page document, I suppose you would look at it and think, well, how difficult can this be to solve or trace? And if you read the book, obviously, there are moments where it seems as if you think you've reached the end of your journey and then something else turns up.
True. You're right. I mean, a perfect example is that, you know, a lot of people say, you know, it's all about Marilyn's UFOs and aliens. A lot of people don't realize that the words flying saucers, UFOs and aliens are actually not mentioned in the document at all. What it talks about is a spacecraft and dead bodies. And I would have thought that if somebody had faked this, somebody had hoaxed this, they would have made sure that they wanted the reader or the readers to know what they were talking about. But by just actually using the words dead bodies and spacecraft actually leaves it actually quite in a sort of a grey sort of mysterious area, rather than actually, you know, making it clear it's about aliens. And in one chapter of the book, I talk about the possibility of something that relates to what's called Project Moondust. And Project Moondust is mentioned in the document at the top of the page. And Moondust was a program that ran from the 50s onward to try and get hold of, like, things like Russian satellites. You know, a Russian satellite goes out of orbit and America tries to grab it to see how, you know, the Russians' technology is versus ours. Mm. Or, you know, if a Russian plane crashed into the Pacific, you know, the CIA would try and get there first and let's haul the material out, you know, and see what they've got versus to us. But Moondust was primarily based around trying to recover or capture Soviet technology that had gone wrong and, you know, plunged into the ocean or whatever. And when you've got a reference to Moondust and you've got references in the document to a spacecraft and dead bodies, I did sort of speculate in the book on the possibility, well, could it be what they actually, that Kilgallen was talking about, was not an alien spacecraft and a UFO, but a very early Soviet flight before Gagarin, and maybe that's what they were talking about. In one sense, you can make it, I don't know if that is the answer, but what I can say, you know, that angle of it not being a UFO and not being aliens, but being a very early Soviet cosmonaut flight, maybe killing the cosmonauts, and we, you know, the US gets the craft first. And it talks about, in the document, about how all of this could embarrass JFK, and I found that kind of weird as well. I mean, I can see why, if it was a UFO and dead aliens, I could see why, you know, people in government would be concerned. They'd be worried. They might be frightened. But I don't think they'd be embarrassed. Embarrassed is kind of a strange word to use in that sort of part of the document. So I kind of, but embarrassment, the word embarrassment, would be perfect if it turned out that there was actually a Russian flight way before Gagarin. That might well embarrass JFK. So, you know, this, again, with the document, you've got these subtleties you know, where if it was a hoax that put it together, well, why not make it straight and black and white so we know what we're talking about? We know we're talking about aliens and UFOs. When, you know, but we all we've got is this sort of, you know, this vague spacecraft, dead bodies, and that's it. And you don't find, I've seen, you know, a number of hoax documents over the years, and what you tend to find is they make it specific as to what they're talking about, because that's the whole goal that they want to get out there. The Marilyn documents doesn't make anything clear, so that in itself is intriguing.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's ambiguity more than anything else, I think, because like you say, I think it's one of those things that unless you really looked at the document, you will make the, oh, it's all about UFOs and aliens. But it doesn't, as you say, refer to them implicitly, which, if it was a hoax and it was trying to get the UFO story out there, they'd be hitting you over the head with it to try and emphasise this point that this is a UFO cover-up of the greatest magnitude.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, the whole thing really, you know, in many respects is, it's like open to anything really, you know. And that's why I decided to sort of, you know, take the approach that I did, was to do it, you know, sort of from 1 to 10, you know, and do it in that sort of diary approach, you know, where I would just go out there, speak to everybody I could speak to, hit the road, and I'd see where it leads me. I felt there really wasn't, you know, another good way of really doing it, I guess.
Is it, I suppose, in conclusion, looking at the book and where it's taken you, Nick, has it surprised you about just how ingrained Marilyn Monroe seemed to have been and given you a greater feeling for her tragic life?
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, the fact is, you know, much of her life, even before she became famous, you know, was tragic. It just, you know, for most people, you know, you get famous, things get better. With Marilyn, it got worse, you know, mainly because, you know, she wanted a stable relationship, you know, and people sort of, you know, play behind her, that kind of thing. And, you know, she had 3 marriages, 3 divorces. You know, it's, so from that perspective, you know, although she had the fame and the money behind the scenes, you know, she was actually, you know, very often, I guess you could say, like a tragic character, unfortunately. And yeah, certainly, you know, doing the book, you know, you do get that feeling, you know, it's kind of like, if only you could go back, you know, that kind of like with the JFK situation, you know, the assassination. It's like, if only you could go back and change things, you know, but you can't do that, you know. So, but yeah, I think, you know, when we're looking at where we are with the document now, the Marilyn documents, my personal view is that it's not an outright hoax. And I don't see any particular reason as to why it should be a hoax. I mean, could it be? Yes, it could. But that doesn't mean it is. You know, I might be sort of sound like I'm sort of scouted around, but the fact is, you know, if the people who want, you know, the truth is that, you know, it really is a complicated story. It's not a straightforward story by any means at all. But, you know, the fact that you've got things like the CIA still collecting information on Spiriglio and his files and his books and things like that, and, you know, there's still this concern about, you know, what's in the Marilyn files that we don't have anymore, what's happened to the diary. You know, what you can see in all of this is that someone – for whatever reason, UFOs or Cuba or whatever, what you can see is that somebody or people within the intelligence community are still concerned and worried about certain things that relate to Marilyn Monroe. And it's entirely possible that one of those is the UFO angle, because we know there was a national security issue in relation to Marilyn, and it related to the Mafia, Cuba, Castro, and so on. And that diary just brings it even, you know, more of a national security issue. So, you know, when people say, well, you know, somebody like an actress cannot become, you know, a piece of national security, but that's not the case with Marilyn. She really did become, you know, someone who was a major figure in the world of national security, and it was all basically all lumped on her. She never asked for it. Mm. You know, it was all basically via the Kennedys. Had they not sort of reeled her in and then recklessly started to tell her all they knew to impress her, they were basically, you know, putting her life in jeopardy, and I think some parts of that jeopardy are still hidden somewhere, still waiting to be found.
Yeah, yeah, because everything else we've kind of covered, Cuba, Castro, the Mafia connections, these are all well known now. There's no disputing these. These were things that were going on, Nick. It's
yeah,
blatantly obvious. So it, what else is there then? That's the thing, isn't it? So clearly there is something else out there that they're clearly concerned about.
Well, I think also you've got this sort of spiralling angle. You know, by that, I mean, a perfect example would be like Marilyn's diary. You know, we've got that one, and then, you know, we've got two more women who die under strange circumstances, their diaries vanish. So in other words, you know, with Marilyn, it's almost as if, because there's so many people interconnected in this story, you know, it starts to spiral. And, you know, in some cases, somebody needs to be bumped off. Mm. It's over and done within 10 minutes, or 5 minutes or whatever. But with Marilyn, because there are these threads and leads all over the place and different people, it's extremely difficult to stop the story from developing. And I think that's what the agencies have revealed. The agencies have realized the more they dig into it, the more they try to hide it, you know, more and more comes out. And I think that's why, you know, they're sort of quietly sort of still survey it, but talk about it too much, you know, and more comes out. And so I think they're more in the case of, let's just say nothing until somebody else says something, you know.
Yeah, very true. I must admit, I found it a thoroughly fascinating book. It's one of those books that it really makes you scratch your head sometimes, because so much of this is in the public record. It really is astounding to see what went on and what is still going on, regardless of what conspiracies fly around or that people might just dismiss it out of hand. Clearly, something's out there that they're still deeply concerned about, and it's a fabulous book that takes us all over the place, and we follow you around, and it's brilliant, and I congratulate you on bringing it out.
Yeah, well, thanks a lot, man. But yeah, I mean, last thing I would say is that the one thing that I think is important, or more important than anything else, is that regardless of what you think about it, all of the aspects of the UFO angle of this do actually mesh together. Mm. You know, it's not like it's just a, you know, calamity of you know, things flying all over the place here and there. You know, you can actually make a coherent story from, you know, way back from John Lear in the 80s to, you know, to 2021 now, you know, and that's an important thing, that you've got this meshing and, you know, the crossovers are all in the right place. And so that sort of gives me, you know, a strong belief that, you know, this is the story. But of course, it's one thing to have the story, and it's another one not to have the diary. You know, what I have to admit, you know, what we need is more hard evidence. You know, there's some fascinating interviews in the book with various people, and documents that have been released through the Freedom of Information Act. But what we need is some kind of smoking gun that is sort of undeniable, you know.
Absolutely. Well, it's a fantastic book and a worthy addition to your collection of work, Nick. So before I let you leave, you've got another book coming up, once again, continuing to embolden your reputation as a writer of great and consistent work. And this one's focusing on time travel, which is one of those subjects that still has a real appetite out there.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, I've been sort of interested, as you know, in time travel from when I was a kid, really, you know, and watching movies and things like that. Yeah, the book, it's called The Time Travel Book, which is an easy title. and it's, although it's not done in A to Z style, it is kind of like that type of book. It sort of covers, you know, the science behind time travel, time travel in the world of entertainment, cinema, comic books, that kind of thing. And also, you know, sort of strange situations where people, you know, believe that they've sort of briefly travelled time, that kind of thing. And just a lot of, and I also talk about, you know, people who have sort of like precognition where they view something, you know, that has not yet happened. So in some sense, things like that, you know, are at least some kind of, you know, sort of, at least some kind of strange situation in relation to time travel. You know, if you have sort of premonition and it comes true, then chances are, in some way we don't really fully understand, that has a bearing, a genuine bearing upon the sort of lineage of time travel, if you like.
I mean, it is something I've always been interested in since I read H.G. Wells's The Time Machine. And then obviously as a kid growing up in the 70s over here, time travel was on every tea time with Doctor Who on a Saturday, you know, so you could go to any place in time. And I think it's a very romantic thing that we have, and as we touched on when we were talking about your Marilyn book, you know, what people would want to do. I think there are so many aspects to it. And the protectors that often, the thing about time travel is the repercussions of trying, perhaps thinking you're going to go back to do the right thing, Nick.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, I talk about that in the book as well, but I also talk about one angle that a lot of people probably don't think about. That is that if you try and go back in time, that the you're not able to do so, you know, that perhaps the laws of everything, you know, prevent it from actually happening. You know, and I kind of find that an interesting angle that a lot of people don't think about, you know, the idea of, you know, trying to do, you know, achieve time travel, but the laws of the universe or whatever actually prevent it. That, so in other words, there's no way to actually have time travel, you know. And that's one of the chapters in the book. And then I've also got a chapter in there, like on doppelgangers, you know, are you actually seeing not just a doppelganger, or is it possibly you're having a sudden, you know, sort of run-in with your future self, that kind of thing.
Yeah. I mean, there are so many layers to it, because often there are occasional paranormal encounters, Nick, where people see... Or perceived to see a ghost, and the ghost seems to react as though it's seeing them, and I often consider them as kind of an aspect of time travel, perhaps, that you're not actually seeing a ghost. You both seem to be, at that point, the veil seems to cross or whatever, and you both seem to be looking at something that's completely out of your world.
Well, yeah, I've actually touched on that. I think I've got maybe two chapters like that where, for example, people have seen sort of almost spectral, like Roman soldiers and that kind of thing.
Mm.
And I talk about, well, maybe they're not actually the ghosts of Roman soldiers. Maybe, and very, very briefly, we have this crossover from 2021 to, like, AD 47 or something, you know, and you've got the, maybe you're actually seeing, you know, an invasion of the UK by the Roman Empire, that kind of situation. And it kind of looks to some people like ghosts, but it could actually be, you know, a sudden, brief look at something that happened a long, long time ago, and then it's a kind of like winks out again.
Yeah. And often as well, one of the facets of the Fortean is that we often get people coming forwards, especially these days. I don't know about you, Nick, but there seems to be more people who claim to be time travellers who go on YouTube to tell us about what the future's like and things like, you know, having laser fights with dinosaurs or fighting Martians or whatever.
Yeah, I've got a few of them in the book. I mean... You know, there's some. The problem with people who claim to have travelled time and, you know, come forward and things like that is that they haven't really come up with something, you know, significantly enough previously to make us think, wow, that person got it right, you know, a year before. I mean, it's like 9/11. I've not seen any kind of forward, you know, pre 9/11 and say on September 11, etc., etc.
Mm.
No, that never happened. That came straight out of the blue.
Mm.
And I would have thought that, you know, we would have had more than that if there are significant numbers of time travelers. One of them would have said, keep a lookout on September the 11th, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Because as you touched on earlier about people having precognitive dreams or visions of future events, there are numerous monumental incidents in history, Nick, where there are very well attested witnesses who will say, oh well, the Titanic is a prime example, but several people changed their bookings because they had a bad feeling about it. Some people, I think one of the children who was on there who actually survived, her mother was convinced the ship was going to sink. Now, maybe that's just natural fear, Nick, but there's a lot of them when it comes to something like the Titanic. And I was listening to a podcast recently that was talking about the Aberfan disaster in Wales in the 1960s, and a lot of people and parents of the children who lost their lives were saying that there were dreams and things going on, that people had a terrible feeling about what was going to happen that day at that school. So...
I've actually got that story in the book.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, it's something that I've often really been fascinated with, especially something like that, because it's such an emotionally responsive event as well, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think with time travel, I think it's not like an either or, you know. I think it's more along the lines of that time travel, I don't think it is kind of linear, and you don't need like a DeLorean and pump in your numbers, you know, or anything like that. One of the things I talk about in the book is that what you actually find is that there's far more cases of people having random time slips than there are people who claim to have travelled in time, you know. Whether through science or a machine or whatever. But yeah, there seems to be far more cases where, you know, some like sort of prophetic dreams, that kind of thing, and, you know, having a view into the future, but you have no idea how you're able to do it.
Hmm.
You know, there seems to be this, the random angle seems to be far else, really.
Yeah, very much so. I think people accidentally seem to fall through time.
Yeah.
Oh, well, I look forward to that. It sounds fascinating and certainly got several aspects of it that you've touched on there that I'm deeply interested to read more about. So, without wishing to sort of prescribe that, what's next on your agenda then, Nick? What's on your hit list next, or what else have you got planned coming up, my friend?
Well, I'm writing one still right now, but it's going to be sort of an A to Z type book, and it's going to be everything to do with robots, sort of going way back to like Archimedes creating these sort of giant claws that he made, and yeah. And right up to, you know, again, sort of the beginning of entertainment, you know, time travel. Robots, you know, in relation to robotics in terms of cinema, TV shows, novels, that kind of thing. But then sort of looking into the present, you know, where, you know, we're sort of developing what you might call sort of real, you know, bionic arms, bionic eyes, that kind of thing.
Mm.
But then, and then towards the end of the book, I sort of focus on, you know, well, is it possible, you know, like in the sci-fi movies, that, you know, the robots may actually be the, you know, the, become the leaders, if you like, you know, that the day comes, oh, possibly, you know, we become them, you know, with, there's all this talk about people having implants, you know, to follow us around, and, you know, somebody else has like a bionic limb. Cloning comes along. I could easily see, you know, in a century or two, how, you know, the human race could be sort of like a combination of sophisticated sort of robotic technology mixed with Homo sapiens, you know.
As we've touched on there, Doctor Who, that's exactly what happens with the Cybermen. They decide to start using implants and bionics to sort of preserve themselves and protect themselves and end up becoming completely robotic through that culture.
Yeah, I mean, it could happen. So basically, again, you know, sort of covered every angle. Well, that's going to be a long time. That's going to be probably end of next year, I think, so something like that.
Well, thank you, as always, for your time. It's been fascinating to get a deep dive into Diary of Secrets and Marilyn Monroe's life. And where can everybody get hold of a copy and catch up with you if they need to?
Well, the book's available at Amazon UK, Amazon US. People can reach me at my blog called World of Whatever, and people can reach me at Twitter, Nick Redfern UFO. Go to Facebook, you'll see me right at the top. And always happy to, you know, help people, or if people got questions, or, you know, they want some advice on something. Again, you know, I'm always pleased to help people, because the way I look at it, you know, all of us, whether it's like you with your show, me with the books, or if you're, you know, a researcher or somebody who's interested, you know, I think it's important, because we're all looking for answers, really. You know, we don't really know all the answers to all of this. So I think it's good, you know, when we can all get together, regardless of which side we're on or whatever, but to, you know, to just get the answers, really.
Absolutely. And it's always a pleasure speaking with you, Nick, and I always look forward to the next chance we get, and hopefully we'll get a chance to speak before the end of the year. No doubt I'll grab a copy of the time travel book and try and pin you down to come back again. Nick, thank you for your time. It's always a pleasure, and you're always welcome on Mysteries and Monsters, my friend.
Right, thanks a lot, Paul.